Good morning, this is AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, we'll talk to some of the winners of Australia Day honours and hear about the concerns there aren't many women among them. And out of Africa, Australian researchers helping to change the timeline of human evolution.
I think that the chronology of human evolution is a big puzzle, and we just put in another key piece of that puzzle.
Almost 900 Australians who are at the top of their fields in sports, science, the performing arts and media have been recognised in this year's Australia Day Honours list. David Taylor takes a look at some of the award winners.
They're the people admired and held in high esteem. Well-known names and the not-so-well-known, quietly getting on and achieving in their communities, workplaces and fields of endeavour.
And there it is! Australia have won the World Championship!
Netball star Liz Ellis becomes a member of the Order of Australia for distinguished services to netball, including leading Australia to a World Championship victory over New Zealand.
It is very, very sweet, and to do it with this bunch of girls is fantastic. We've been training hard.
She looks forward to the day when women's sport is given equal credit.
Receiving this honour is part of that. I can keep that conversation going.
Quality shot after quality shot. As often happens when it's windy, the cream rises to the top.
Former women's world number one golfer, Kari Webb, is now an officer in the Order of Australia for distinguished service to golf as a player at the elite level and to the development of female golfers.
And another sensational shot. Take Kari Webb to 12 under.
It's been really rewarding for me. Obviously share the experiences that I've had throughout my life and my career and hope that it positively impacts these girls and gives them some tools to hopefully get the best out of themselves.
Olympic champion Shane Gould has been honoured for significant service to swimming and to water safety programs in developing countries.
When a person has finally understands, the water holds me up, you know, that is just, to me, that's the ant's pants.
For that, she becomes a member of the Order of Australia. Another leading woman in her field, Professor Jenny Martin, is being honoured as a companion of the Order of Australia for eminent service to science and as an advocate for gender equality in science.
If we want to tackle the challenging problems the world faces today, we need all the best minds around the table, not just half of them.
Oxfam CEO Helen Sirkay has been recognised for her work as a human rights advocate, becoming an officer of the Order of Australia.
It's incredibly rewarding when you're able to have a direct impact on making changes that allow people to have a better life.
Former Australian Medical Association Federal President GP Mukesh Haikerwal nearly died after being assaulted and robbed by five men in Williamstown, Victoria in 2008. He also becomes a companion of the Order of Australia.
I mean, to get an award like this is something that you have to stop and breathe in and understand just what it means.
He now helps treat young Australians with mental health issues.
The work carries on.
Commercial beekeeper Trevor Weatherhead wants to spread the buzz about bees.
It's been estimated between $4 and $6 billion worth of agriculture and horticultural crops that rely on honeybees, and a lot of people don't realise this.
He picks up a member of the Order of Australia. And Professor Cress Eastman is being recognised for his efforts to abolish iodine deficiency disorders throughout the developing world, dubbed the man who saved a million brains.
That was Australian effort, Australian money that went to provide that outcome.
Professor Cress Eastman, ending that report from David Taylor. Once again, there's frustration that not enough women are being recognised. Only a third of the inductees to the Order of Australia are women, and that's lower than last year. It's sparking an outcry from former award winners and gender equality advocates. Oliver Gordon reports.
Murray Coleman has been a trailblazer throughout her life. The first woman to head a government agency in Australia, she was named an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2011. But this year, she's appalled that the number of women receiving similar honours has fallen by more than 1%.
Good heavens! Only one sector has nominated more women than men, and that's librarians. Hello? We need a much more proactive system of organising organisations and individuals to nominate women.
In contrast, the UK's New Year Honours list came close to gender parity in 2018, with women making up 49% of those recognised.
The UK made a very conscious decision a number of years ago that they wanted to ensure that there were equal numbers of men and women, and they've done it.
Carol Schwartz was named a member of the Order of Australia in 2006 for her contributions to business and the not-for-profit sector. She's also calling for reform.
I think that there needs to be some real systemic change around the honours system. I think that, you know, it's been discussed and acknowledged now for years that women are underrepresented in the awarding of those honours.
Dennis Moriarty is a former senior Victorian public servant who in 2003 received Australia's Centenary Medal, which honours those who've made a significant contribution to Australian society or government. He argues the honours system loses credibility whenever the gender balance is skewed towards men in prominent or prestigious professions.
Women have been underrepresented, the community workers have been underrepresented, and the politicians and the captains of industry are the ones that are stealing these awards and making the awards meaningless.
The Order of Australia awards are approved by the Governor-General of Australia. A spokesperson from the Governor-General's office said there was more to be done to achieve its goal of greater gender parity, but positive steps were being taken.
More men than women are nominated for the Order of Australia. However, over the last 12 months of our campaign to increase diversity in honours outcomes, we are delighted to report that there has been a 40% increase in the proportion of nominations for women.
Minister for Women Kelly O'Dwyer says she wants to see more women awarded, but she says it's up to the public to ensure more women are nominated for the honours system.
I would certainly encourage more Australians to nominate more incredible women from their communities.
Federal Minister for Women Kelly O'Dwyer ending Oliver Gordon's report. Scientists, a maths teacher and a sporting star. There's been an eclectic mix of winners at the Australian of the Year Awards. But despite their diverse backgrounds, they've been unified in their messages about the importance of education and making the most of opportunities. Our reporter Tom Iggledon was at the ceremony in Canberra.
A game of chess against her father started it all for this year's Australian of the Year. A young Michelle Yvonne Simmons checkmated him twice, exceeding both his and her own expectations, and got her wondering what else she could achieve. Now she's a world leader in quantum computing, heading a team of researchers at the University of New South Wales.
We're down to earth, we judge by results, and we believe in what's real. Our distaste for authority means that we think for ourselves. And best of all, we're prepared to give those hard challenges a go.
The British-born Simmons says she'll use the award to encourage young women into the sciences.
Know that reward comes from hard work, and some of the biggest rewards come from taking on the biggest challenges. And understand there are many opportunities here as there are anywhere else in the world. Unlike me, you don't have to go overseas to realise your dreams. You can realise them right here.
Professional footballer Samantha Kerr could hardly have imagined what she's achieved. When this year's Young Australian of the Year winner was growing up, there were no female professional footballers.
You don't do things for money and you don't do things for, you know, accolades like this, but, you know, at the end of the day, if you chase your dreams and do what you love, you'll succeed.
You've spoken about wanting to be the best in the world and proving people wrong, and that's what drives you. Do you think that's a message that could translate, especially for young women, to other pursuits outside sport?
Yeah, 100%. I think trying to be the best at whatever it is in life is a really good thing. And I think, you know, girls these days sometimes maybe can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think having role models again is the reason why it's so important. And I think nowadays, you know, young boys and girls are in good hands with the role models all across Australia that they have.
Young Australian of the Year, Samantha Kerr, ending Tom Iggledon's report. Sydney maths teacher Eddie Wu has won the Local Hero Award. He's a household name to tens of thousands of students who watch and learn maths from his online classes. So perhaps it's no surprise Eddie Wu is calling on the community to value education and support teachers. He's speaking to our reporter Stephanie Boris in Canberra.
My parents emigrated here from Malaysia, and they knew coming here was such a conscious choice for them to obtain education for me, my brother and my sister. I think what happens for anyone when you grow up around something and it's just there, like clean drinking water, you just learn to take those things for granted. And I feel like that's a somewhat of a necessary evil having public education. And so we just need to be conscious of that and say, okay, this is something you're going to grow up expecting, but it's really valuable. It's not normal around the world.
It's not an easy job by any means, and we see a number of young teachers going into the profession but then leaving. Why do you think that's the case?
A big part of why so many teachers leave the profession definitely is just it's an objectively challenging profession. Day to day, it's so confronting. I remember my first year of work, you just get dropped into the deep end, and every day is, I've never done this before, and I've got the perhaps the world's most difficult audience in front of me. 15-year-olds do not suffer fools gladly.
So how do we ensure there is that enough support in the school sector so we've got the brightest minds and the most enthusiastic people working as teachers?
There have to be formalised structures for the mentoring and support of new teachers when they enter the profession. There are a few structures right now, but it's quite low, really, and it's not structured equally in every school. So having that structural support there, hugely important.
You've talked previously about how you were bullied at school, that children stole your books, that you were beaten up. Do you think racism is still prevalent in schools today the way it was when you were at school?
The Prime Minister last night said it really well in terms of, we are an ancient culture, but we're also brand new. I've got sort of Doctor Who going through my head right now. I'm thinking of a TARDIS. But I think that what that means is that every generation has to learn afresh what it means to get along and understand and appreciate people who are fundamentally different.
Do you think we have moved forward? I mean, you're out in the classroom every day. You do playground duty. What do you see? Do you think there have been changes since you were at school?
I do think that there has been a slow march of progress. And
I feel there's a but coming on.
There is. I mean, I think that now when I stand up, and I've been so touched by how many people have come to me and have just sort of grabbed me by the shoulders and said, you're someone who makes us so proud to be an Australian. That really makes my heart hurt in a great way, because I could never have imagined that 20 years ago, someone coming to me. It shows something about, yes, we've moved forward, but I never want us to, as a society, to fall into the trap of thinking, okay, well, that's done now, because I don't think that's the way that society is going to truly embrace diversity and appreciate the things that unify us without diminishing the things that distinguish us. We're never going to become great, we're all the same. It's precisely the fact that we aren't the same that makes Australia so wonderful.
Local Hero of the Year, Eddie Wu, speaking to Stephanie Boris. Understanding how food grows and how we can be smart about farming as the climate changes has been the lifelong professional focus of the Senior Australian of the Year. Professor Graham Farquhar is a biophysicist based at the Australian National University, and I spoke to him earlier. Graham Farquhar, good morning and congratulations.
Thank you, Kim.
You looked a little bit stunned when you were announced as the Senior Australian of the Year. What does this award mean to you?
Well, it's recognition. I've had awards before that are for my science. So what's so special about this one is that it's coming from the much broader community. Yeah, wonderful.
You've been recognised for your work in protecting food security in a changing climate. So what worries you about the future of food production in Australia based on your research?
Well, I think Australia's probably better off than most places because we've got a lot of land per, you know, per person. And so if you add up how much rain gets made available per person, Australia's way better off than America or China, places that we normally would think of as having, you know, a wetter climate. But we've got, when you add up all the rain that falls in Australia divided by a smaller number of people that we have, we're actually not too badly off. But water's always, as anybody who lives in Australia knows, water is such a variable, it's so variable in its availability that I think that'll remain true for some time.
Mm. When did you know that you first wanted to pursue a career in science?
I think about age 3, I think.
3?
I didn't know. Well, my father was an agricultural scientist. I mean, he was an agricultural officer, district agricultural officer in Tasmania, taking information from scientists to farmers. And as far as the family was concerned, he was an agricultural scientist. And I wanted to be like my dad.
And what do you think helped foster that interest as you went through your school years? Because we've heard a lot in recent years about the need to ensure students are studying science and maths. So do you have some tips of how to actually make that happen from your experience?
Good teachers are vital to maintaining student interest. I was curious. And so the question is, why was I curious? Firstborn, more curious in some senses about the world, because there's nobody to tell them, no siblings to tell them what's going on. Having good teachers is fundamental.
In your acceptance speech, you talked about the risks and rewards of chasing lofty goals. What do you hope to do as the recipient of this award over the next 12 months?
The award brings some responsibility, and in my case, I'm the senior Australian of the year, and so I feel a particular responsibility to promote conditions for senior Australians to contribute to Australia's greatness. It's a tremendous resource among senior people. If we take senior as being from 60 on, an awful lot of IQ and muscle. So the issue is how to harness this without putting at risk jobs for younger people. And so I'd like to talk to people who are more expert in this area than I am and just find out how is it that we can have the best of both worlds? How can we keep the accumulated experience and wisdom of older Australians and allow them to still contribute without getting in the way of jobs for younger Australians?
Well, Graham Farquhar, congratulations once again. Thank you very much for speaking with AM.
Thank you, Kim.
Senior Australian of the Year, Dr. Graham Farquhar. Tens of thousands of people are expected to mark today as Survival Day or Invasion Day in recognition of the dispossession of Indigenous people. One of the Prime Minister's Indigenous advisers believes calls to change the date of Australia Day are getting too loud to ignore. But the federal government says protests are unhelpful, as Bridget Brennan reports.
For one of the largest Indigenous organisations in the country, there's a clear consensus on the date of Australia Day.
It's very clear from our members, over 25,000 members, that the date needs to be changed. We want to celebrate with non-Aboriginal Australia, but just not on that date.
Roy RC is chairman of the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, and he also serves on the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council.
Why not the fourth Monday or the last Monday in January? You know, as an option to celebrate, it gives business certainty. It gives non-Aboriginal people and the general public an opportunity to keep the date, and we all celebrate together. We all come together. And it's all part of that healing process.
Queensland's Australian of the Year, the NRL star Jonathan Thurston, supports calls to change the date.
I think people need to be educated on why this date is so, why our culture doesn't feel inclusive on this date. You've got to remember, it's not just about the First Fleet, it's about the stealing of the land, misplacement of the stolen generation. Yeah, I think we certainly need to have a chat about Australia Day.
Neither the federal government nor the opposition support moving Australia Day. The federal citizenship minister, Alan Tudge.
To those people who want to protest about Australia Day, can I just say, protest about the country on every other day of the year if you like. But let us enjoy Australia Day for what it is, and that is a great celebration of everything that is terrific about this country.
Melbourne Council's the City of Yarra and the City of Darebin will not hold citizenship ceremonies today. Daniel Nguyen is the Mayor of the City of Yarra and says today is an inappropriate date for celebration.
I guess from myself personally, it came from the fact that the local community, our community in the City of Yarra, whether it be Aboriginal people, Indigenous people, or the wider community, had come to us and asked, well, what are we doing? Acknowledging the fact that the day is a day of mourning for some people.
While the Melbourne councils have been in the spotlight, several other communities no longer celebrate on the 26th. Flinders Island off Tasmania's northeast coast ditched official Australia Day celebrations 5 years ago. And for the Aboriginal communities at Yarrabah and Palm Island in Queensland, Australia Day doesn't get a look in.
Indigenous Affairs reporter Bridget Brennan. In the lead up to Australia Day, Indigenous people from across the country have been holding workshops in Sydney to discuss a renewed push for a treaty. Our reporter Stephen Smiley caught up with some of them.
Josie Crawshaw is a Gurindji woman from the Northern Territory whose ancestors, led by Vincent Lingari, staged a walk-off and strike at Wave Hill Station in the 1960s. She's opposed to the date of today's holiday, but says there are bigger challenges for Indigenous people.
Changing the date doesn't change our situation. We still have the battle of really having that truth-telling and feeling we can be really reconciled as a country.
And it's that battle that's brought her to Sydney this week for a series of workshops with about 60 other Indigenous people on the topic of treaty.
We are veterans of a 238-year war, and we believe that a treaty, while it's not the panacea, but there are many modern treaties, we've got a chance to learn from them and strengthen and give us real influence and power as the sovereign people of this country.
What form that treaty might take remains a subject of discussion. And Terry Mason, who's an Indigenous union leader from the Newcastle area in New South Wales, isn't envisaging a quick resolution.
Treaty may not be settled in my lifetime, probably won't in a satisfactory form. But if it takes us 20 years to do this right, we must do it right.
Terry Mason's critical of the process that led to the so-called Statement from the Heart earlier this year. He also has concerns about how the state government in Victoria is going about negotiations for a promised treaty with the Indigenous community in that state too.
They're establishing in Victoria the concept of setting up an Aboriginal corporation to negotiate a treaty. That's virtually the government negotiating a treaty with its own corporation, in other words, itself.
Kaurna woman and Adelaide Indigenous rights activist Katrina Gullapina Power agrees consensus remains some way off. She's suggesting reserved seats for Indigenous people in the National Parliament, but first wants to hear whether other Indigenous people agree.
I'm not going to set myself up as some queen of Aboriginal Australia. I'm not going to preempt what it might look like. I want to wait to have the and do it proper culture way, not media way, not politic way. Black way, full stop.
That's Kaurna Indigenous activist Katrina Gullapina Power speaking with our reporter Stephen Smiley. This is AM and it's 21 minutes past 8. If you feel like the world is heading closer towards an apocalypse, it may give you some comfort to know the scientific world agrees. The doomsday clock has been moved to just 2 minutes to midnight. It's the closest it's been to disaster since 1953, as Angus Randall explains.
The world is becoming more vulnerable to catastrophe, and the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which controls the doomsday clock, knows where the blame lies. Rachel Bronson is the organisation's president and CEO.
To call the world's nuclear situation dire is to understate the danger and its immediacy. We considered the ossified state of arms control negotiations and non-proliferation agreements, as well as new testing undertaken by North Korea, nuclear exercises built into Russia's military plans, and an enhanced commitment to nuclear weapons in Pakistan, India, and China.
Several nuclear-armed nations are being accused of bringing the world closer to annihilation, but one name rises above all others.
We considered at length the lack of predictability in how the United States is thinking about the future and future use of its own nuclear weapons, an unpredictability that is embodied in statements and tweets by the President of the United States.
The Doomsday Clock was created in 1947 by scientists who helped develop the first atomic bomb. It's a metaphor for how close mankind is to destroying the Earth. The last time it was this close to midnight, 65 years ago, the United States and the Soviet Union had just tested hydrogen bombs. Fellow Bulletin member Sharon Squassoni fears a lack of communication between the US and Russia could push that minute hand closer to disaster.
For the first time in many years, in fact, no US-Russian nuclear arms control negotiations are underway. And if the draft US nuclear posture review is any guide to US policy, there will be no U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control negotiations for the foreseeable future.
However, Lawrence Krauss is one member of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists sounding a hopeful note.
If governments are not acting to protect you as they should, you need to take the lead. You need to demand action. It is not yet midnight, and we have moved back from the brink in the past. Whether we do so in the future may be in your hands.
Lawrence Krauss from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, ending that report by Angus Randall. Fiji's Electoral Commission has decided that a number with satanic connotations will not be used during the general election later this year. It's announced that 666 won't be among the numbers that are used to identify candidates on the ballot paper. Here's Pacific Affairs reporter Liam Fox.
It's been said politics and religion should never mix, but that's not easy in Fiji.
A lot of people are Christian, and I would guess that a substantial number of candidates would be Christian.
Savanatha Narumbe is the leader of the newly formed Unity Fiji Party and will be contesting his first general election when it's held later this year. He supports the decision of Fiji's Electoral Commission this week to remove 666 from the numbers that can be assigned to candidates on the ballot paper.
I think we just look at the sensitivity of that number in a country and the makeup of Fiji. And if you are a Christian candidate, then if you have allocated that 666, I think that would be quite untenable.
In the New Testament's book of Revelation, 666 is referred to as the number of the beast. In modern popular culture, in movies, books and music, it has come to be associated with Satan and evil. Savanatha Narumbe says having 666 as your number on the ballot paper would be a significant handicap. Under Fiji's electoral system, a single electorate covers the entire country, so there's only one ballot paper for all the candidates vying for a seat in Parliament. They will be identified by a number only, not their name, their picture, or even a party logo. While he welcomes the decision to remove 666, Mr. Narumbe says there should be more information on the ballot so people can accurately identify their preferred candidate.
We in opposition parties, we have made submission to the Electoral Commission that at least they allow some sort of indicator that will help a voter make his choice, his right choice, some symbols, some picture. The Electoral Commission has refused.
The ABC requested an interview with the Electoral Commission through the Fijian Elections Office, but there's been no response.
Liam Fox reporting. Australian scientists are rewriting the timeline of human evolution by helping to put a date on the earliest human fossil found outside Africa. The fossil from the maxilla, that's the jawbone, was found in Israel in 2002, and it proves early humans had moved outside Africa more than 50,000 years earlier than previously thought. Rachel Mealy reports.
It's not a small question. Where do we come from and how did we get here?
I think that the chronology of human evolution is a big puzzle. And we just put in another key piece of that puzzle.
Professor Rainer Grun from Brisbane's Griffith University admits it's a big puzzle, and at the moment only 7 pieces have been found. He's held one of those pieces in his hands, and he and his team, together with other scientists from around the world, tested the fragment of the maxilla bone and the teeth attached to establish its age.
So the detailed analysis of the teeth basically gave us insights to the species it is. So a compelling case was made that it's a Homo sapiens.
The global scientific team has estimated the bone and teeth to be up to 194,000 years old. This advances the understanding of the movement of Homo sapiens around the world, moving our clocks back by more than 50,000 years.
We hope that in the future we will get more and more pieces of the puzzle together that we can ascertain with fossils and fossil sites the insights that we have already from genetics.
The team's findings have been published today in the journal Science. Professor Grun says he would never have imagined that such advanced techniques for testing the age of a fossil would have been available to him.
Well, I have to say at the beginning of my career, I had no idea how it would end up 40 years later. But it was a time before mobile phones, and we used magnetic tapes to record our data. So it's quite different. And if you look at the equipment that we used at the time, you think you go into a science museum.
Rainer Grun says more fossil discoveries across Asia are needed to understand how humans arrived in Australia.
Now we really want to find sites, on the way to Australia, in India, Persia, Saudi Arabia, and then Southeast Asia, to really understand how fast human migrated and how they ended up in Australia.
Professor Rainer Grun from Griffith University in Brisbane, ending Rachel Mealy's report. To finance now, and the Dow Jones has had another record close, rising 0.5%. Oil is $65.32 US a barrel, and the Australian dollar is still just above 80 US cents. And that is AM for today. AM's executive producer is Nick Grimm. The associate producer is Barney Porter. Political producer is Alexandra Beach. Technical production by David Lawford and Mariam Zahr. Digital production by Laura Briley-Newton and web publishing by Matthew Bates and Amelia Tan. I'm Kim Landers. Sabra Lane will be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend. It's now 8:30.